From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
And I'm Jane Clayson. It's Here and Now. After nearly 2 weeks of uninterrupted violence, the people of Israel and the Gaza Strip go to bed tonight amid the fragile silence of a ceasefire. Officials reported a small skirmish between Palestinians and Israeli police today, but no more rockets. The fighting between Israel and Hamas claimed more than 250 lives, many of them civilians. In its wake, a humanitarian crisis in Gaza and possible political reckoning for Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Joining us now from Tel Aviv is Niri Zilber, journalist and analyst with the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. Welcome back, Niri.
Good to be back.
So the truce, brokered with Egypt's help, started early in the morning in Israel. It is nighttime now there. How has the day gone?
The day has been quiet. The ceasefire has held, and it was expected to hold, I believe, after 11 days of fighting. I think on the Palestinian side, Hamas, it entered this round of hostilities for political reasons and scored some political victories along the way at devastating cost, I think, to the people of Gaza. But it scored some victories, and I think it was indicating all throughout this past week that it was ready to end things. It hadn't fired on Tel Aviv since Saturday, so almost a week. And on the Israeli side, the sense is that they could have kept going, that Netanyahu and his government perhaps wanted a bit more time, but President Biden and his administration actually reined them in, and they brought a halt to at least this round yesterday.
What are you hearing, Niri, about the situation for people in Gaza? There were some celebrations at word of this ceasefire, but there is also massive devastation.
That's right. It's a paradox. The toll on the Gazan side, obviously, much higher than on the Israeli side, although life in Israel for most of the country almost came to a standstill as well. But really, we can just look at the numbers. A lot of more devastation on the Gazan side. But there was a lot more celebration on the Palestinian side overnight and into today. We saw Gazans take to the streets, honking horns, shooting off fireworks, not only in Gaza, but in Jerusalem as well, the West Bank, even some Arab-Israeli towns inside Israel. And so they're at least outwardly projecting this as a great victory. They stood up to Israel and the mighty Israeli military. And on the other side in Israel, a lot more subdued. There's a lot of opposition criticism of the government for not going far enough. A lot of the citizens, especially in southern Israel, that have been bombarded for years now by Hamas rockets, also angry that a harder hit wasn't landed on Hamas. But really, life has returned back to normal in Israel as well, and that's probably all for the good.
Briefly, what do we know about the details of this truce?
Quite vague. Someone once put it, it's a non-paper that's not worth the paper it's not written on. The best anyone could hope for really after this round was a halt to the fighting. There was no further understandings, no further conditions that were placed on either side. And so a halt to the fighting is one thing, but really the underlying dynamics between Israel and Hamas that rules the Gaza Strip haven't changed and in many respects may have gotten worse. I think the politics on both sides have hardened.
Talk about that politically, the politics of this, specifically for Prime Minister Netanyahu within Israel.
Well, we were talking about paradoxes. So maybe the sole victor of this round, at least politically as well, might be Bibi Netanyahu. He went into the current hostilities in very real danger of losing power and being replaced by an alternative coalition, a change government, as it's called here. But in the middle of the fighting, one of the key partners in this potential alternative government actually rescinded the option, took it off the table, caved to right-wing pressure from his own base. And so now the opposition to Netanyahu aren't really looking at a realistic option for an alternative government. Neither is Netanyahu himself. But as we've seen now over 2+ years of political stalemate in Israel, elections come, elections go. There's no conclusion, but Netanyahu remains prime minister as on top of a transition government. And so he may have gotten out of this round, at least politically, but it remains to be seen whether the public will grant him another chance if it goes to yet another election.
Last question with about a minute left here, Niri. Put this all into context for us. How does what we've seen over the last 11 days fit into the history of this conflict?
Look, sadly, it's yet another round of bloodshed, needless bloodshed, in a long-running conflict. I think if there is one silver lining coming out of the hostilities of the past week and a half, it's that the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, and primarily the Palestinian issue in question, needs to be front and center, not only for Israel, but the Biden administration and the international community. And in recent years, it's been kind of shunted aside. Israel, at least many Israelis perceive it as, or at least perceived it before these hostilities, as a non-issue. And it really needs to be addressed appropriately, responsibly, fairly. And so if there is one silver lining, it's that you can't just ignore either the humanitarian and political crisis in Gaza, Hamas-ruled Gaza, we should add, a terrorist organization, as well as moderates in the West Bank, the Palestinian Authority, which have been seeking negotiations with Israel. They're much more moderate and yet haven't really found a willing partner, at least in this Israeli government.
Many hopes today that this ceasefire holds. Journalist Neri Zilber, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
And that's not the only conflict the Biden administration is thinking about this week. North Korea's nuclear weapons program tops the agenda today as South Korean President Moon Jae-in visits President Biden at the White House. The two leaders are also expected to discuss efforts to counter China and South Korea's struggle to get enough COVID-19 vaccine doses for its people. NPR White House correspondent Aisha Roscoe joins us now. Aisha, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Sure. Now, we're going to get to the agenda for this meeting in just a minute, but why don't we start with these two leaders, Biden at the beginning of his presidency and President Moon at the end of his.
Yeah, so, I mean, they're both in very different places, and Moon is not in the place he probably wanted to be at this point in office. He wanted to likely make much more progress when it comes to North Korea, but there's been a global pandemic. And you have Biden coming in, and like so many other presidents, U.S. presidents, he's looking at a Korean peninsula that has North Korea that is hostile and bombastic and still has nuclear weapons. And that hasn't changed despite all of the maneuvering and the pressure that numerous U.S. administrations have put on North Korea.
And the signals that we're getting from the White House are that the Biden approach will not be the same as the approach that the Trump administration took. The former president, of course, we remember, made it personal, talking about his relationship with Kim. But there were also three high-profile summits that didn't really bring any breakthroughs. So what is Biden's North Korea strategy? Do we know yet?
So they've been a big bit vague, but what they have said is that it's not going to be a grand bargain, which is what the Trump administration wanted. They were willing to, you know, get rid of sanctions if North Korea gave up all of its weapons. So it was going to be the grand bargain. The Obama administration had strategic patience, which was basically this hands-off approach where they didn't really deal with North Korea too much and just kind of, you know, kept it at a status quo. What the Biden administration is saying is that they are willing to engage in diplomacy. They're willing to engage in incremental steps if North Korea will take steps that are of equal measure. So they're willing to take a baby step on sanctions or something that North Korea wants if North Korea takes a baby step towards capping its nuclear weapons program. So it's a more incremental process that they're trying to go for. It's unclear whether North Korea will actually go for that, though.
And how does that mesh with what President Moon wants in South Korea?
I think the tough part for Moon is that Moon is going to want more from the U.S. than the U.S. may be willing to give. The Moon wants a more stable peace. He wants a serious agreement. He wants talks. But to get that, the U.S. and the Biden administration is not going to be willing to give North Korea big sanctions relief in return for intermediate steps. It just is not going to work for the Biden administration politically. And so it's going to be difficult in some ways for Moon and Biden to get on the same page. I'm sure they will say they are working in united, but Moon may want the U.S. to go further.
Well, we also know the pandemic will be an important discussion in this meeting. South Korea has not been getting the doses of vaccine that it needs as quickly as it needs them. What is South Korea looking for from the U.S. on this front?
South Korea is hoping to do a sort of swap with the U.S. where they will get doses now in exchange for providing the U.S. with doses later on. And they point out that they were helpful to the U.S. when it came to testing at the beginning of the pandemic because the U.S. obviously had issues with testing and South Korea had done a really good job with testing for COVID. So they're hoping to get some type of, payback now.
All right. NPR White House correspondent Ayesha Roscoe. Thanks as always.
Thank you.
Just in time for the weekend, two American musical giants are out with a new album today.
I got a long black electric Cadillac. Should go 1,000 miles on the charge. I got a long black electric Cadillac. Should go 1,000 miles on a chart. I'm running subterranean air conditioning and a full electron photo array in my backyard.
That's Long Black Electric Cadillac from Leftover Feelings. New music from John Hiatt and Jerry Douglas, the master singer-songwriter and the master dobro player, meshing their talents with terrific results. The music website Holler calls it a match made in heaven. And John Hiatt and Jerry Douglas are with us from Nashville. Welcome to Here and Now. How nice to have you.
Thank you, Jane.
Thank you, Jane.
John Hiatt here and Jerry Douglas there. And
Jerry Douglas over here on this side.
On that side.
Whatever side that
might
be.
Which side are you on?
I'm on the side that wins.
We've only just begun.
Indeed. Yeah. No, this has been a rolling thing since we left the studio back in October, Jane. Yeah.
So I can tell you've been friends for a long time, and I understand it. You've also been neighbors, and for those who may not know, you're each revered as one of the greatest artists in his respective fields, but you've never worked together on an album, which really surprised me. John, how did this project come about?
You just said some lovely things about us. Let me tell you, I was sitting talking to my manager, and we were just kicking back and forth ideas for what I might want to do for the next recording, and we do that before every record. And he just started talking about, well, have you ever thought about making a record with Jerry Douglas? And I said, it never occurred to me. I don't know why. I didn't think he'd, I'm not in that milieu of amazingness, So it was like, really? Jerry Douglas? Boy, that'd be awesome. Mm. This kind of was my reaction.
My manager asked me, and I said yes immediately because, who wouldn't want to do that?
Let's listen to another song from the record. This one is called All the Lilacs in Ohio.
When you met her there on the New York City stair, you were throwing up on your shoe, trying to write the great book. Well, it really had you shook with a bad case of winter time blue. So he drank her down to the ragged side of town, shared a taxi to carry her home.
John, this is a song that fits the record's title, certainly, Leftover Feelings. It's about a love that never quite happened. Are you looking back in this set of songs here?
This was one of three songs that were not kind of fresh. I actually recorded this song with the Goners back in 2003 on a record called Beneath the Scruff Exterior. And we did a kind of a raucous, four-piece rock band with wild slide guitar player Sonny Landreth kind of thing. And I always, when this project came up, it was the first song I thought of for something I would love to hear Jerry's take on and his band of Merry Men.
Jerry, yeah. You've worked with so many musicians over the years, but your band seems to be the perfect complement to John Hiatt's singing and his songs. Did it feel that way to you?
Yes, it did feel that way to me. I mean, my rule number one is do not play on top of the singer. So people can hear the words. And those guys subscribe to that same theory. And I knew they would be the perfect guys, and we decided not to use drums. So my poor drummer, he's home. He's going to be home for a while.
Sorry about that.
But we carried it. You know, you don't really miss drums. I mean, for me.
I certainly didn't, and we've heard comments from people who've heard the record. They say, I was 4 or 5 songs into it before I realized there wasn't a drummer.
Yeah, who's playing drums?
Yeah, who's
nobody.
Playing drums?
Right. Mm. But these guys were ready to surround a song like what John Hiatt would write.
Mississippi phone booth, in the middle of the night. Bugs flying everywhere, crazy in the gas station light. Heart pounding through my t-shirt. I've been changing a call to you. Mississippi phone booth.
How much does the feeling of this record reflect where it was recorded? At the historic RCA Studio B in Nashville, of course, the birthplace of Nashville sound. It's where Waylon Jennings and Dolly Parton, even Elvis Presley, recorded there. What was that like, John?
You know, I kind of thought it would be intimidating, but it was quite the opposite. It was as if, you know, you had it's like they're cheering you on from within, you know, from within the walls.
Looking down on you.
Yeah, really. Well, definitely. But it was, you know, it's like another musician in and of itself, kind of, the room.
Yeah. And an X on the floor where Elvis had his sweet spot, right?
Indeed, which I knelt down and kissed, much like you would the yard of bricks after winning the Indy 500.
I saw him do it.
Yeah.
I want to listen to another song from the album. It's called Light of the Burning Sun.
The message was seen. The task was done. Prayers offered up in the night. Face the light of the burning sun. My brother was dead. By his own hand, a gun in the glove box, 'cause he carried money for my old man.
John, you wrote this song about your brother who took his own life when you were just 11 years old. And as I understand it, you've never written about that until now.
I hadn't. I've dealt with it my whole life, and I don't know what shook loose in me, but I sat down one day and started playing those melancholic chords and that little figure that kicks it off, and the song just shook out.
Jerry, you obviously play on that song and the other songs on this record, but you also produced the album, and so I'm curious, how did you approach this particular song as a producer in all of its sensitivity, especially for John?
I heard the song and I realized the seriousness in it, and decided that we would just paint around it. Especially in one spot, there's a lyric about when his father learned the news, and then his mother hears the news from a policeman, and Mike Seal played this really low, ominous chord, and it just permeated the track and accentuated what John was saying. You know, and you could visualize what was happening. To me, that brought it all into view.
The message was seen. The truth to tell. The officer tried to catch her as she wept and fell. My father screamed no. Beat on the wall, shook the foundations of the house, shook the life out of us all.
priest came by. He was undeterred.
Well, neither of you have been able to play live in concert, of course, because of the pandemic, but you guys do plan to tour together later this year. You must be looking forward to that, huh?
We're so excited.
We've been looking forward to this for a year. We were supposed to record this album April a year ago, and then tour in August of 2020, and this the pandemic set everything back a year. We did get to go into the studio last October and start the record and get a jump on the whole situation, but it was a long time waiting to get in there. I mean, it's going to be exciting to get out on the road and play these songs.
Yeah.
Well, on the album and in person, it sounds like you two have a lot of fun together. You certainly have magic together. This record is phenomenal. Thanks so much for being with us and sharing
Thank
it with
you.
Us today.
Thank you, Jane.
We sure appreciate it.
John Hiatt and Jerry Douglas, their new album, Leftover Feelings, is out today.
He's a king.
What happens after a police officer shoots someone who's unarmed? For decades in California, internal affairs investigations, how the police themselves, were secret. Until now. Listen to On Our Watch, a podcast from NPR and KQED.
Chances are, if you had a routine doctor's appointment during the pandemic, it was a virtual visit. When the virus hit, government regulators relaxed the rules on telemedicine, and now companies are lobbying hard to keep those changes. Rachel Kors is Washington correspondent for our partners at STAT, the health and medicine publication. Rachel, welcome.
Thanks for having me, Peter.
It has been boom times for the industry in the past year, hasn't it? How much would you say it's grown?
It has. It's grown just exponentially. I mean, it's kind of beyond the wildest imaginations of the players who were in this space before. I mean, as I talked to companies that have made their business telehealth, I mean, they're talking about hundreds of percentage increases in just kind of the patient volumes that they've seen. And those, it has tapered off a little bit, but just the volumes that they've seen, kind of the freedom that they've had and the investment that they've gotten has really just been unprecedented.
Mm. Used to be, it was really difficult to see a doctor over the internet unless you lived in a really remote place. So what were some of the changes that happened with telemedicine during the pandemic that now that people are starting to kind of go back to real life, I put that in quotation marks, that these companies are trying hard to keep?
Right. Well, that's a good question. And I think as doctors' offices shut down last spring, government regulators didn't really have a choice but to relax so many of kind of the restrictions that they had put on telehealth in the past. And some of those were, for example, now Medicare pays doctors the same, whether they see a patient in person or see them via virtual visit. Healthcare providers can get paid for like audio visits, and, you know, doctors can see patients in other states, which has been really helpful for telehealth companies. Because if you have a patient who, you know, wants to make an appointment in Kentucky, you don't have to have a doctor in Kentucky to do that. So those are a couple of changes. I mean, really, Medicare used to make patients go to an actual in-person clinic to have a telehealth visit with maybe a specialist somewhere else. So, I mean, these changes have really changed the game in terms of, you know, mm-hmm. who can access telehealth and from where.
And if they were to go away, those changes, and the industry is, you know, again, governed by the pre-pandemic rules, what happens?
The analysts that we talked to for this story said that, you know, there could be some very serious financial consequences for companies that have kind of built their business on this telehealth boom. And one company that I spoke with, Doctor On Demand, said that they, you know, may need to scale back and just not offer like mental health services to Medicare patients if some in-person requirements that Congress decided to kind of use as guardrails are kept in place after kind of the end of this year. So, I mean, the stakes are very high for patient access here.
This industry grew very rapidly because of the pandemic, but there was never any promise that the regulations that were relaxed during this time would be permanent. I mean, this is a rare situation that we're in now. So why is there an expectation that it shouldn't go back to the way it was before?
I think consumers really like telehealth, and I think that's something that the industry is really hoping to leverage moving forward. It happens in Washington all the time that businesses will make investments based on regulations that aren't necessarily guaranteed, but this was a whole nother level where they kind of saw the financial opportunity. And it's kind of conventional wisdom in Washington that once you give someone a benefit, it's really hard to take it away again.
Rachel Kors is Washington correspondent for our partners at STAT. Rachel, thank you.
Thanks so much.
On May 22nd, 2017, a bomb exploded in the Manchester Arena in the United Kingdom. An Ariana Grande concert had just ended, and fans were on their way home. Cell phone videos captured the chaos after the blast. Twenty-two people were killed and dozens more were wounded. 4 years later, their families still have questions about what happened. Only one person, the suicide bomber's brother, has been convicted in the attack. But an investigation by the Times of London links the bombing to Libyan drug gangs that operate in the Manchester area. David Collins is the paper's northern editor, and he's with us now from Manchester. David, welcome.
Hello, Peter.
And before we get to your investigation, just remind us how shocking this bombing was. It was the worst terror attack in the UK since the London Transit attacks in 2005.
That's right. I mean, I think at the time it woke people up again to the dangers of extremism. And I mean, it was doubly shocking, really, because it was an attack on children. And the suicide bomber, Salman Abedi, he walked into the foyer and he walked into a crowd of people full of young girls. One of them was an 8-year-old girl called Safi Rose Roussos, who was a little girl who used to love to sing and dance and leave little notes around the house saying, "I love you," to her mum and dad. And she was one of 22 that were killed by that bomb.
And I think even 4 years later, it's still hard to talk about. Here's Prime Minister Theresa May the morning after the attack.
"It is now beyond doubt that the people of Manchester and of this country have fallen victim to a callous terrorist attack. An attack that targeted some of the youngest people in our society with cold calculation."
The bomber died in the attack. He took a taxi to the arena that night. The driver even noticed how heavy his backpack was because the bomb was inside. He gave a copy of the Quran to the driver and said, "Pray for me, brother." What else do we know about the man who did this?
He was born in Manchester to Libyan parents. Ramadan Abedi, the bomber's dad, he fought against Gaddafi as part of a group of Islamist fighters, basically, because they wanted to have a Sharia state. They wanted a government which was driven by Islam. Gaddafi, obviously, that was a kind of challenge to his power. So a lot of the people had to leave Libya in the 90s. A lot of them came into the UK. And a lot of them settled in South Manchester, in a community in South Manchester, which is nicknamed Little Tripoli.
So was that point of view from the father then passed down to the son? I guess I'm trying to understand what kind of ties or connections he would have to terror groups.
I'd certainly say absolutely that the father was a hardline Islamist who had connections to people in Al-Qaeda, Anas al-Libi. His Anas al-Libi's sons were close to Ramadan's sons as well. He had three sons. The middle was Salman Abedi, who was the actual bomber, the suicide bomber on the night. Hashim Abedi is the youngest brother. He was convicted last year for, I mean, it was a record, 55-year minimum sentence.
But he was the only person convicted in this case. In fact, he's the only person who was even tried in the case. But in your investigation, you found plenty of evidence that the brothers didn't act alone. What else do we know about that?
A lot of it is based around this community, which is called Little Tripoli, where you have all these kind of dissident Islamist fighters who settled and had families themselves, and they had children. And a lot of those children went on to become ISIS supporters. You know, they'd have extremist videos, they'd watch extremist videos, they'd swap extremist material within their peer group. So the links our investigation found was between the attackers, Salman and Hashem, and a group of Libyan drug dealers. So a lot of the individuals suspected of dealing drugs and convicted of dealing drugs as part of these gangs were also involved potentially in the Manchester Arena bomb. They know this because they have CCTV from an apartment block where a car was parked. Now, in that vehicle, Salman Abedi and Hashem Abedi kept all the bomb parts. What the police had was evidence of these gang members going up to the car in the weeks before the attack, checking on the car, walking around the car. In one case, a gang member was seen wiping the car, so they suspected that potentially they were trying to get rid of forensic evidence. The same people, some of the same people who were checking that car, were also had their mobile phones tracked to very close to where Salman was making the bomb in the hours before the explosion. And these same gang members who are at the car and they're near where the bomb was built, they've got, you know, they're receiving calls from Libya in the days before the attack. So what you get is a jigsaw of evidence which points to the fact that they were probably helped and assisted by a network of people.
And so why haven't any of those people been charged?
That's the interesting thing. And a lot of the families that I've spoken to who lost loved ones at that concert are baffled by it. And part of the reason is because in this country, what you have is a system where the police investigate and they put together a case file of all the evidence. And then they give that file to the CPS, which is called the Crown Prosecution Service. And they are basically lawyers who assess how strong the case is. And part of that assessment is they won't recommend the charge unless they believe there's a 51% chance or greater of a successful conviction of that person based on that case file. Mm-hmm. So they're basically, their job is to second guess what a jury might do. And there's good reasons for that because, you know, the police might put forward a very weak case. However, there are two or three individuals, I would say, a strong circumstantial case connected them to the bomb.
Then that must be so frustrating for the family members, you know, who probably are still wondering where justice is 4 years later. What else are you hearing from them?
I mean, it's a difficult week for them, this. So a lot of the families cope with it in very different ways. Some leave Manchester completely. Some of the members of this Libyan gang, they fled to Libya after the attack, or they're still walking around Manchester. Some of them have been called to give evidence and at this public inquiry, and they haven't. So it's a mixed bag of feelings for the families. So, I mean, some Fegan Murray, for example, who lost her daughter, she is very kind of, you know, she believes in forgiveness and kind of hope for the future, and she forgives the people behind the bomb for the attack. And some take the absolute opposite, eye for an eye approach. Steve Howe, he lost his wife. His wife was waiting for his daughter to come out of the pop Ariana Grande pop concert. And I think for people like him, they want to see these anybody connected with the bomb to be brought to justice, which I'm completely sympathetic towards.
David Collins is Northern Editor for the Times of London. We're going to link to the investigation into the Manchester Arena bombing at hereandnow.org. That attack happened 4 years ago tomorrow. David, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And now an update on a story we shared with you yesterday when we heard from the four finalists for National Youth Poet Laureate. Well, now we have a winner. Congratulations to 18-year-old Alexandra Huynh of Sacramento, California. Here she is speaking with Here and Now about using poetry for self-expression.
I'm able to process darker emotions, and poetry is a great problem-solving space for me because I have to confront what I feel and why I feel it. And in knowing that, I know how to find a way forward.
Alexandra will visit with students and hold workshops around the country over the next year in her new role as National Youth Poet Laureate. She also plans to study engineering at Stanford in the fall. A poet engineer, that is so cool. You can read Alexandra Huynh's work and poems from the other finalists at hereandnow.org.
One year after the pandemic threw the entertainment industry into disarray, broadcasters like ABC, CBS, NBC, and Fox, along with media companies like Discovery and Warner Media, have now released their plans for the fall TV season and beyond. A lot of favorites like Brooklyn Nine-Nine, This Is Us, and Black-ish will be airing their final seasons, and Don Cheadle will be starring in a remake of The Wonder Years. For more now, we're joined by NPR TV critic Eric Deggans. Hi, Eric.
Hi.
It's been a rough year for network television. Tell me what struck you about the new shows announced for the fall.
That's for sure. You know, the broadcast networks in particular, I think, were trying to show that they still have creative and decent programming and that they haven't been knocked off the media chessboard by the pandemic. But what struck me about it is that we're seeing a lot of stuff that we've seen before. A ton of police procedurals and crime dramas. Not very much comedy. Both NBC and Fox have fall schedules that don't have any comedies on them.
Yeah.
And as you mentioned in your introduction, some really well-known and acclaimed series are going to have one final season, including Brooklyn Nine-Nine, This Is Us, and Black-ish over the next TV season.
So what's up with that? The right time to end these shows? Have they run their course, or what's the reasoning there?
I think that's exactly it, particularly with a show like This Is Us. It makes sense to me that after six seasons, they would say, you know, we've told all the stories we can tell about this family before it starts to get ridiculous. Mm. And Black-ish, I think if you've watched that show on ABC, it's a great pioneering TV show, but it also has been on for a long time and has run its course. And knowing that they're going to go off in a year gives them a chance to build towards a great finale, and it makes room for what may be more vital programming next year, hopefully.
Well, let's talk about that. The Wonder Years on ABC is on the fall lineup, and this one's getting a lot of buzz. Don Cheadle is starring here. It'll be set in 1968, features a black family. Here's a clip.
It's the little things that you remember all your life. Your first hit. Your first kiss, the first time your dad lets you know that he sees you. Well, I still hadn't had the other two, but boy, did that third one feel good.
Eric, what else do you know about this show?
What's interesting to me and what it says, I think, about this moment is that there are a lot of networks that are trying to do better on diversity and not just talking about white characters. So on the one hand, you have these cop procedurals, which, you know, tend to be white-centered and aren't necessarily talking about the subjects that people of color care about. And then you've got these other dramas and comedies that are featuring people of color. So it'll be interesting to see a TV season featuring both of these kinds of shows.
Well, during the pandemic, droves of people picked up services like Netflix and HBO Max and Disney Plus. And as you mentioned, broadcast TV has really been lagging in this area, of course, behind streaming. Is there anything in the new TV lineup that you think would attract new audiences to traditional network broadcasters?
You know, I hate to be a downer, but my job as a critic is to be honest. And what I see here is a lot of retrenchment. I see a lot of stuff that's just permutations of things that we've seen before and not a lot of risk taking. And what we saw happen over the last year or so is that these big media companies like NBC Universal, Warner Media, Disney have all aligned themselves so that they're focused on creating content for their streaming platforms. And so the broadcast networks kind of are no longer the bells of the ball. So I think now is the time for broadcast TV to prove that it has a constituency and to prove that it has value. But judging by what I saw from this upfront, there's nobody taking a big swing to come up with something really creative. And ultimately, I think they may still continue to see audience declines that along the level that we've seen in the past.
So, Eric, what are you most looking forward to then in this fall lineup?
Well, I do have to say I am really interested in this Wonder Years series because I'm a huge fan of Don Cheadle, and I'm a huge fan of the idea of rethinking old concepts to see if you can mine new ways to talk about them. You know, Dick Wolf, this guy is amazing. This is the guy who's the executive producer who's in charge of Law & Order, and he also developed the FBI franchise for CBS. He has something like 9 shows that are going to be on the fall schedule. There's going to be a new Law & Order that's focused on defense attorneys, which I'm interested in seeing. And CBS is also doing something where they're bringing back CSI. And so I'm interested to see what they will do with these characters who all presumably have aged. You know, a few interesting things that I'm looking for in a fall season that is mostly not very inspiring.
Well, we'll look forward to it. And I must say, after this year, I do need a comedy, Eric. I do need a comedy.
You might have to look to streaming for that. I hear there's a show called Friends that is doing some kind of reunion on HBO Max. So you might want to check that out. That's all I'm saying.
That's NPR TV critic Eric Deggans. Eric, thank you.
Thank you.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jane Clayson.
And I'm Peter O'Dowd. It's Here and Now.